Hey, how are you? My name is Kevin Avani, the Total Connector. I'm the host of the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. I'm really excited to have Thibaut Maréchal back on my show. He's written an excellent article on, on the purchase of 21,554 Bitcoin by MicroStrategy, which is owned to approximately 25% owned by Vanguard and BlackRock. As you know, they are the biggest fund and wealth asset managers. And so the question is for me, you know, are CFOs, chief financial officers, senior management officials, decision makers, or also in other institutions now obliged or sort of in a breach maybe of the fiduciary duty, responsible due diligence, if they do not at least develop a capital allocation to Bitcoin? So are we already, you know, sort of at a tipping point to a real institutional mass adoption? Could take still some years, but you know, as Parker Lewis said, gradually, then suddenly. So without further ado, I'm really excited to go down the rabbit hole with Thibaut Maréchal. And let me know if you have any questions, pound that like button, please subscribe to my channel and my YouTube channel, my podcast platforms, and write me anywhere a positive review on iTunes or wherever. It would help me tremendously. Thank you so much again for your support and for listening. Welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My name is Kevan Davani, also host of the Total Connector Show. Today is August 18th, 2020. Bitcoin is at around, what is it? Thibaut, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kevan. It's good to be here.
So, first of all, your article that you published is, I don't even know how many articles you've published, but I think because you had not written much or published before this article on the blog site of NuxCustody.com titled Is Bitcoin the World's Safest Reserve Asset? Published right. On August 14, 2020. It's a brilliant article. I love your article. It's super concise and it's super beyond bullish. So maybe you want to break down a little bit, you know, the essence of that article, because it's about the NASDAQ listed, the intelligence software company, MicroStrategy. But what is more interesting to me is also the ownership structure, which is Vanguard and BlackRock, which is, you know, in the macro investing sphere or space is super like well known, because they are like super fund wealth management institution managing trillions of dollars, right, of assets.
Right.
So the title of our episode, I chose that title deliberately because I think that's the key to a chain reaction of institutional mass adoption. I chose the title Fiduciary Responsibility, Fiduciary Duty to Develop Capital Allocation to Bitcoin. So my question, I think, would then be, I'm going to talk about this later on, but my question is, when would the time come where CFOs or whatever they're called, chief financial officers, or you know, in that rank, senior management officials, decision makers in that league, would be actually in a breach of fiduciary duty or responsibility, due diligence, not to at least develop a capital allocation to Bitcoin, or plan, or at least allocate, or literally not allocate a certain percentage of their cash reserves into Bitcoin. All right, it's your stage. Thank you so much for coming.
Right, thanks, Kevan. It's really good to be here. I mean, there's a lot to unpack in that news. I guess the reason why I wanted to write this article is because there's been a little bit of news coverage around this release. But there wasn't really anything when it came to actually like what it meant for Bitcoin and for other companies that are listed on public markets. And so I thought, look, if I'm asking myself these questions, I'm pretty sure a whole bunch of other people are thinking the same thing, are trying to research the space and trying to understand like what it actually means for these two things. And so yeah, that's how it came about, really. It was out of pure curiosity. It was an exploration, another rabbit hole that I guess did a deep dive into following this news. And while I'm far from an expert in treasury and corporate fund management, definitely there was a lot to discover there, and I think there's quite a bit of learnings for a bunch of other CFOs and fiduciaries who are managing these types of holdings. Now, saying that today it is a breach of fiduciary duty to not have an allocation into Bitcoin is perhaps a bit of a stretch, and maybe it was sort of a teasing kind of hook that I wanted to include in that article. It's a narrative that is crafted, but definitely, if you look at CFOs and other executives in charge of managing treasury for these listed funds, it seems obvious today that they should actually know of Bitcoin and actually have done a little bit of research and due diligence when it comes to understanding the properties of Bitcoin, like what makes Bitcoin cash, what makes Bitcoin perhaps the best cash in the next decade or so, being again resistant to inflation and devaluation. And so, yeah, I mean, if you look today at the role of treasury managers, they do allocate to a bunch of different asset classes, and these of course include bonds or other foreign exchange markets, and so on. And so I mean, again, like from a risk reward standpoint, Bitcoin seems to be quite an obvious bet for me personally, but again, it's because I've been lucky to be in the space and I've done my research. But so again, like having a little bit extra documentation and literature outside of our own echo chamber, I think will benefit a whole bunch of other executives. At least I hope that's the goal, right? We all win there, getting a better money for our companies. And then, of course, like if you think in terms of all the repercussions of having an allocation into Bitcoin when you're managing a treasury, it's massive, right? Because if you start, let's say, allocating, not as MicroStrategy did, like a 50%, but if you start allocating 10% of your excess cash reserves, and then that 10% becomes 50% in 5 years, and I'm being conservative, we both know that, or maybe I'm not, but anyway, the number go up, technology will definitely, force managers to think through what it means to not hold Bitcoin. And I think this opportunity cost will come, pretty strong at these people who've been ignoring it for the last decade. And you look at, again, I think Andy Yee from Visa posted this great tweet speaking about the career risk and the fact that this risk for both hedge funds and now CFOs have been nullified or substantially reduced with the announcement of MicroStrategy in, investing such a massive allocation, and also Paul Tudor Jones allocating 1-2% of his portfolio. So we're seeing, an institutional adoption. I think not the one that we expected at first, like thinking that family offices would start, preserving their wealth in massive amounts in Bitcoin. And even though I personally do believe that this time will come, it seems like the first institutional adoption comes from corporate treasury, at least the public one that we've heard of recently. And indirectly, interestingly enough, it comes from other really large wealth and fund managers, the likes of, again, BlackRock and Fidelity and Vanguard, who are allocated into, the equity and the cap table of MicroStrategy. Like MicroStrategy's cap table, I think, is 97% institutional funds. It's over 400 funds that have equity in that company. And so now all these funds, even though they're not holding physical BTC, they do have price exposure to Bitcoin via MicroStrategy's balance sheet. And so again, it's going to be fascinating to watch like what happens to the stock price of MicroStrategy over the next, let's say, 12 to 24 months, as you know, we enter the bull market and Bitcoin price goes up. Interestingly enough, you know, MicroStrategy's price, stock price should also go up. And that is not going to be a function of their earnings necessarily, or you know, their top line. And I think Preston Pysh was mentioning this on a podcast with Stefan de Vera. And so again, what happens to valuation models, right? Because if the stock price of MicroStrategy goes up by 10x over the next 24 months, because Bitcoin's price is going up 10x, then the PE ratio of this company is going to go through the roof as well. And so of course, you know, other competitors will notice, but then what happens to the valuation models that all these funds that do have exposure to MicroStrategy, like what are they going to be doing with those new numbers? Does it mean that the company is overpriced? Because these are all unrealized gains, right? And until they sell, like it's just going to sit on their balance sheet as an asset that has a massive unrealized gain. And so anyway, all of these questions I think are fascinating, and I really don't have answers to all of them, but I think it's as the first step, it's really interesting to start asking ourselves this question and start thinking about what it means as a community and as the little echo chamber that we are on Bitcoin Twitter.
Yeah, the analysis or the statements that have been given by the CEO, what's his name, Saylor of
Michael
MicroStrategy,
Saylor,
yeah, and their team. I mean, it's really remarkable. And you've quoted it, you know, in pretty lengthy in your article. Anyone I should recommend to read the article itself. So you mentioned before that, and you quoted, I think, Andy Yee, Senior Director of Public Policy at Visa. He said that the MicroStrategy move effectively removed career risk for CFOs from putting company treasury into Bitcoin. So that should be sort of my transition to my next question is that, you know, there's like I don't know how many global pension funds there, you know, pension funds globally. It's forecasted that they're going to reach approximately $60 trillion in 2025 from previous $42 trillion in 2018, growing at a 5.4% compound annual rate, boosted also by Latin American assets, blah blah blah. And so do you see pension funds coming into this game? Because now, because they have to consider, you know, the macroeconomic development, you know, the insane central banking printing of money, the over-leveraging of debt. So, you know, the whole insolvency crisis that is about to come also in the European Union. I mean, you know, sort of from the much bigger perspective, do you think the CFOs have to are now forced to consider all these factors, parameters, and are playing.
Yeah, it's an interesting question when it comes to CFOs and sorry, pension funds, I wanted to say, and then you know, the allocators that are responsible to manage these holdings. I mean, they're more risk averse, right? Because they're retirement funds that are deploying capital for, you know, really long-term horizons. I think sometimes it's 20, 40 years type of capital allocation strategies. And so even though I'm a big Bitcoin bull, I think it's going to take a little bit more time for these types of fiduciaries to decide to make material allocations into Bitcoin. But again, I may be wrong here, but just looking at the risk appetite of these managers, it seems like it's they're going to be the one of the laggards when it comes to actually investing in Bitcoin. Though again, if you look at their main allocations today, pension funds are mandated to invest in material amounts of bonds and fixed income, which today have been pretty bad at returning yield. And also another part of their mandate is to hit specific targets when it comes to return. And so again, like you can hit a certain nominal rate, but with upcoming inflation and all that, your real returns are going to be pretty low as a manager of a pension fund. And so again, I wonder where these capital allocators will deploy their dry powder in the coming years. So Bitcoin is definitely a saver for these types of funds long term. And this is why I wrote this headline in the article, like fiduciaries need Bitcoin. And again, if I think that is true, if their mandate do not change and they are still required to hit those real rate of returns that approximate, you know, 5, 6, 7%, then, you know, good luck finding that in traditional asset classes. And again, it's all a matter of building those risk-adjusted returns that do make sense in terms of volatility for these, again, like long-term funds. But it, again, because they're focused long-term, they shouldn't be too sensitive to Bitcoin's short-term up and down volatility. If they're buying those allocations for the next 20 years, you know.
I mean, one could argue, it's interesting what you're saying. You know, one could argue that $250 million for let's say for the owners, for the ownership structure of MicroStrategy is really nothing. It's like a drop on a hot stone. So it's and it's what those whatever 25,000 or how much Bitcoin was that? 21 or 25,000 Bitcoin?
Yeah, 21,000 Bitcoin roughly. Mm. So what is 0.1%.
Yeah.
Of the total supply.
Yeah. So, and we are at the market capitalization of Bitcoin at 250 billion right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it shows us how early we are still. So, so if they're, you know, you're thinking of, you know, not only family offices, pension funds, global pension funds, who's sitting like of on 50, 60 trillion of dollars wealth and fund management. That's nothing. So could it, do you foresee like a sort of a, do you think that's a quiet before the storm, like sort of a, it's a gradual, it's rather like according to Parker Lewis, it's sort of a real gradual, and then it all comes suddenly in 5 years, 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, just I just looked up the number, but on for pension funds, roughly the total assets under management for these funds is $8.6 trillion. And that's only for pension funds, right? You look at corporate treasury right now, only on the balance sheet of the top 100 companies that are traded in the NASDAQ, they hold over like around $1 trillion worth of cash, right? And cash equivalents. That's only for, you know, top 100, and it's only for NASDAQ. And again, it appears that the next bull run could be partially led by corporate, you know, debt financing, right? Because again, there's such low interest rates that are instilled by central banks to stimulate the economy, that these companies essentially, with their balance sheet that they can leverage, can acquire substantial amounts of liquidity and cash and just deploy these reserves into Bitcoin. And that, I think, again, that may very well happen because they're going to have a few benchmarks in the marketplace. And the first one being MicroStrategy, right? They opened the floodgate is open now. They're going to be, like, if I wrote this little article, I'm pretty sure there's a whole bunch of other analysts on Wall Street that are looking at that company, and they will definitely monitor the evolution of this position and how the stock price of MicroStrategy behaves. And so if you think of just the operators that are also looking at that, because again, Michael Saylor being the CEO of a listed company, you know, they're pretty close together, all these executives and CEOs, and so they talk, right? So definitely, like, a lot of other operators, I'm pretty sure, I've heard of this, or perhaps thinking about this. They're perhaps building their internal theses and investment strategies. And they're they perhaps even already deployed and we don't even know it because they haven't done a press release yet, right? Because one of their board members isn't really comfortable with the decision yet or something. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Who knows, right? I'm totally speculating here, but it's an interesting narrative to follow. And so, yeah, if you start looking at the potential corporate FOMO that will unfold in the coming months, it could be interesting. And, you know, we had this these discussions on Twitter about whether or not the fiat speculative attack would come from consumer credit. So people like you and I just taking on loans and buying more Bitcoin with this, essentially destroying the value of fiat over time. This may very well happen from corporates instead first, right? And then, you know, what happens when you're a fiduciary managing large amounts of capital on behalf of other investors, you're going to see the price of Bitcoin go up. You're going to see all these corporate balance sheets super strengthened and you know, liquid also. At some point, you know, as a fund, you're going to have to step in and actually allocate your capital to that asset. So to Parker Lewis' point, gradually then suddenly, right, we may get quite a bit of a FOMO in the next cycle. But I still don't believe that hyper-Bitcoinization is going to happen before 3 or 4 cycles, but we shall see.
Yeah. But the market capitalization of Bitcoin could reach easily like $1 trillion in the next few years. I mean, that's realistic. I mean, when you look at the hyperinflationary tendencies unfolding, when you just look at the central bank and monetary policies and all the experts saying, you know, also in the European Union, Europe, that there we have a huge insolvency crisis. The banks are insolvent. And you know, now even, you know, the ECB, as, you know, Draghi said in March, whatever it takes. So you know, we just zoom out and look at the bigger picture. What choice do all these institutions have than to allocate into Bitcoin? They can allocate to gold or whatever, or productive capital, you know, stocks, real estate. I mean, what choice do they have? That's my question.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, from trying to be as objective as possible and looking at the properties that Bitcoin have as a money, it definitely is the best sort of set of parameters, right, in terms of soundness of money. And so again, that's why it comes back to this point that we made earlier. Fiduciaries will have to do extensive due diligence, and if they don't do that, they may be just sitting on their laurels, and that again is a breach of their responsibility. And so they may have to actually do the hard work. And when it comes to researching Bitcoin, it still is quite a tough, it's the learning curve is steep, but the amount of literature and just reading and great books and podcasts that there are out there is growing extremely rapidly. And I mean, it's improved 10x or, you know, over the last few years, over the last 2-3 years. We're super lucky. So, and we're all contributing to that, you know. So I guess at some point it's gonna be tough to be in finance if you haven't heard of Bitcoin and you don't actually understand it. Let's put it this way.
Yeah, and it shows a degree of ignorance by now, I think, if you haven't heard or at least, you know, understood the fundamentals of Bitcoin, right?
Right. Yeah. And then if you look at incentives, I guess, some like traditional, whether it's asset managers or banks, they don't necessarily have an incentive to actually see Bitcoin rise to be a successful monetary asset, because Bitcoin as this, you know, massive gravitational pool of capital will definitely at some point lead to deflation in other asset classes as investors divest from these asset classes. If you look at, you know, whether it's real estate or just the stock market or gold, All these asset classes are, they do have accrued monetary premium over the last few years because our fiat currencies are super bad at holding value. And so, yeah, definitely if you start seeing Bitcoin rise, most of these positions will divest. And so you're going to see deflation in those asset classes, which is not necessarily desirable for all these entities that are allocated quite substantially to these asset classes. So again, I think it's still better to be able to adopt Bitcoin because you choose so, not because you have to, you must. But at some point, it's going to be a must for people, and if they don't do the switch in a timely manner, they're going to get wrecked. And that again, this ignorance is going to be pretty costly for fund managers.
It'll be interesting to see once Bitcoin is considered as a denominator. I mean, you've also talked about this in your article, where all kinds of currencies or whatever, or gold is indexed to Bitcoin. There's this graph I'm just showing on the screen on your article.
Right.
So, do you think that'll be something, huh? If Bitcoin all of a sudden is the denominator, because
Right.
that's the real peg, that's the only real a sound peg that one could, compare with.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you look at any asset class, actually, compared to Bitcoin, it's gone down over the last 10 years substantially, right? You look at this graph from Unchained Capital's blog, it's from Parker Lewis' Gradually Then Suddenly series. And yeah, it's from 2014 to 2019, it seems like the dollar, the euro, the yen, and gold are totally going to zero. It's an abrupt fall. And that is true for real estate. That is true for the S&P 500. And so again, you can't be asleep at the wheel and not take notice as someone who's responsible to manage capital. Now, of course, there's not only return, right? You have to consider risk-adjusted return as a fiduciary managing capital responsibly. And so, but again, adding 1, 2 to 5% allocation to your portfolio of 60/40 stocks and bonds, it's been proven to reduce your Sharpe ratio, the overall volatility of your portfolio, and also the I think the max variance on the downward trend when it comes to losing value in your portfolio. So again, these are all really important aspects of wealth management to consider, and Bitcoin definitely will be part of that equation in the coming decade. Now, there's no turning back. When it comes to Bitcoin as a numeraire, which is again what Preston Pysh described with Stefan Levera in another episode, I wonder when this is going to happen. Like, at what market cap? If it's if it's going to be the I guess psychological mark of $1 trillion, or if it's going to be the total sum of U.S. dollars that is actually in circulation plus U.S. treasuries, which I think is roughly 30 trillion. But what's interesting is that Bitcoin is already a unit of account for some of us, right? I personally price my life in sats, and so anytime I want to make a big purchase, not like bread or groceries, like that is, I guess, not 100%. I'm not doing it religiously yet. Maybe I will, but when it comes to bigger purchases at over $200, I'm definitely thinking in sats. I'm like, okay, am I comfortable like just getting rid of that today? Is it going to be worth that much in 5 years, 10 years? So definitely, again, it happens on an individual level, right? But at some point, because everybody does it, including individuals and corporates, then everybody does it, right? And so when that happens is still So TBD.
You wrote also in your last paragraph in your article about the stock-to-flow ratio. Now, there seems to be sort of a, I don't want to call it controversial, but sort of a dispute, debate about, you know, the real, I don't know, what do you call it, the implications of, or is it, like, is it real? Is the stock-to-flow ratio, or could we even, I don't know, consider it as an ex post confirmation thing, because you know it's hard, you know it's getting harder and harder, of course it's yeah. With an absolute scarcity, so of course people, the more people understand, comprehend the real fundamentals of Bitcoin, it's foreseeable of course that people are gonna buy into it because it is absolutely scarce. I don't know, how do you see the this whole this so-called controversial discussion going on with the stock to flow ratio?
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy in that regards. I believe that predictive modeling on such a complex matter that is human action is a very Keynesian thing to do. you know, it's pretty hard to understand how the collective human kind will actually price Bitcoin. Though I guess it's a very, personally, I find it a really interesting model to understand the past for sure and to speculate on the future. But I don't think people should hold it religiously as you know, the be all type of model. Again, models are by default wrong, right? And so it's sort of a good proxy to make sense of the world around us, but it's not something that is 100% comprehensive. So yeah, I mean, that would be my my comment on that. It's overall predicting the future is impossible, and so I just read it from afar, and I'm pretty excited to see that. Sure, Bitcoin price evolution seems to be following roughly the stock to flow model, but you know. Is it going to be 100% co-integrated over the next decade? To me, it seems quite unlikely because the model doesn't price in inflation. And so it assumes that inflation, actually the value of fiat currency, which is in that case the US dollar, is going to stay constant, but it's not. And so if you look, you know, again, I wrote in my article the balance sheet of the Fed over 3 months during the COVID outbreak and the hysteric response, it blew up by 72%. So that's just the total, like, it's a new wave of money that's been injected into the economy. It's been inflating the stock market, which, you know, that's how we got our quote unquote V-shaped recovery there, but that money at some point is going to flow downward into the economy and is going to, you know, decrease the individual unit of value for the dollar, and so that is not taken into account in Plan B stock to flow model. So at some point the model basically is bound to fail, is bound to break when hyper bitcoinization happens or hyperinflation happens, right?
Because it would exceed actually even the expectation or the prediction of the model. I mean, then it, yeah. we could actually say, you know, the logarithmic function is actually exponential, way more exponential. This is what I also said to Plan B once. I said, you know, what if it just, you know, surpasses every other expectation? Because I mean, for me, it's logical because you have to, calculate or consider every parameter. I mean, with its FOMO, greed, it's the, you know, increasing exponential hardness of Bitcoin, the scarcity, the difficulty adjustment, the halvings every 4 years, the macro conditions going on, you know, like MicroStrategy like coming in, all these big institutions coming in, that would accelerate actually the process. So then it would be sort of a, you know, check mark, you know, oh, we knew it's going to happen,
right? And I think to, again, what Plan B mentioned in his latest update on the model, it was that 99.5% of the model is actually like the R square between the stock to flow model and the spot price of Bitcoin over time has a correlation of 99.5, which means that there's only 0.5% of external events which influence Bitcoin's price. If that's the case, then yeah, you sort of leave a little bit of room for a MicroStrategy, for a ban, for a bunch of other external unpredicted events, and the rest, like Honey Badger, doesn't care. We shall see how this happens.
So, and then staying in that last paragraph still, I really loved your last sentence, or your la the last sentences you wrote. You said, once Bitcoin gets adopted by most companies, a global and sustained deflationary future may await us, allowing responsible capital allocators to invest soundly accumulated capital for truly productive uses, as popularized by Jeff Booth, author of The Price Tomorrow, whom we had actually with together with Titus Gebel on the show just recently on my show. So, did you read his book?
It's here. I just got it. I just got it. It was my opening. It was like I'm gonna sneakily inject that reference in the end, and it'll force me to read it.
Now you're gonna love it. I read it, I think, three times because also as a preparation for the interview, I also read Titus Gebel. The two. That's why I really had the desire to bring them together. I thought, oh my God, this is a beautiful fusion of free private cities, whatever you call it, Bitcoin citadels and self-sovereign cities with deflationary economics, 0-to-1 technologies, a Bitcoin standard. and everything else around it. So this was sort of a vision that I had with after reading those two books, and that's why I call Stephanie von Jahn co-moderated a discussion because I dropped off and off. It was just terrible. My internet connection got lost with thunder, rainstorm, and then the electricity went off. It was really crazy at that day. Anyway, so yeah, you're gonna love it. I think you're really gonna. I'd really love to do it like a continuation of this talk, maybe in the near future with you. What's your thoughts on deflationary economics and as Jeff Booth says, it's inevitable. It's coming like a gravity, and central banks, government are totally in a totally schizophrenic state of mind. They are like in a. The government central banks are totally like doing inflationary monetary policies and everything else, ruining everything, and then you've got the deflationary technology. So these are
What's
two
interesting is,
opposite
yeah,
forces.
we sort of experience it every day, right? With technology already. Like everyone has experienced it and everyone loves it because you get more as we get better at producing stuff. It's phenomenal. I mean, why would anyone be against deflation? And I think that's
Exactly.
the it's that's the mania of central banking and Keynesianism, like assuming that things like prices should go up and we should have a stable arbitrary rate of inflation. I find that fascinating that they sort of like legitimize this school of thought and that everybody now takes it for granted. There's a fun parallel to be made here with between central banking and Ethereum, right? It's so complex that nobody really cares what happens.
It's obfuscating complexity. Did American HODL
Exactly.
say that or something like that? I'm not sure yet.
Exactly, yeah. And so nobody, is, I guess, comfortable asking questions because they feel too dumb to ask the questions. And that's true for central banking and Ethereum as well. And that's how, I guess, side note, that's how Pierre Rochard a few days ago on Twitter with Bitstein created the supply gate, because no one had actually asked how to verify the supply of Ethereum. Central banking, at some point people are going to ask, okay, so like why do we actually need that 2% inflation, like, or what the fuck happened in 1971? Like I'm seeing all these graphs like go nuts after this year. And so yeah, again, when everybody starts asking those questions and realize that there's no legitimate answer. Individually, you fall down the rabbit hole, but at some point, you're gonna, trying to escape that paradigm and shift to another one. And usually, that one is Bitcoin. So.
Do you have the impression that there's an exponential learning curve taking place right now, or is it not really like rooted in mainstream yet? I mean, or do you think people are asking themselves at least some kind of questions, some kind of, legitimate questions, like what the fuck is going on?
Again, personally, I can speak about these experiences. Recently, I've had a few friends who actually decided to buy Bitcoin
Wow.
regularly, or like one lump sum of $500 or something. And yeah, it's because they've seen the immense amount of money that was created out of nowhere. And even though they don't have the details about where that money went, they're like, yeah, but if all that money is created, then why bother pay taxes, or why bother, work 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, right? And so they're like, okay, there's something weird going on there. Like, people feel that that something is not straight. And yeah, again, like my generation, right, were millennials in, let's say, mid 20s to mid 30s. And I mean, real estate is overpriced. Today, getting a loan is pretty hard, if not impossible, in the current environment. Stock markets, so you need to be really good and understand the companies and the industries in which you're investing. Otherwise, it's pretty like it's a gamble. Gold, like, who buys that as a millennial, right? So again, like you're left with not that many options. And bonds, like, same thing. So Bitcoin is definitely a really compelling asset because you can buy a fraction of it. There's no speculation at all if you understand the properties and the long-term horizon that you need to take. And I think that the narrative as that emerged in terms of savings is also pretty compelling. I feel like millennials do save more than boomers. I have a few friends or friends of my parents who are boomers, and they consume a lot. They were lucky to acquire a home at cheap prices, and yeah, they just consume and spend. It's not really in the mentality to save, whereas our generation, millennials, I feel we do save a bit more. So Bitcoin
Maybe
on
the
that is
boomers are more
that's
of a
vehicle.
spoiled generation, you think, because of their spoiled generation, because they've sort of enjoyed, the asset inflation. It's an asset inflation still going on, right?
Right. Probably it's a combination of both, yeah. The asset inflation and the fact that they're pretty comfortable with welfare state. Especially in France and Europe, it's pretty common to have quite a dominant state when it comes to support, when it comes to retirements. Like here in France, for instance, like all French people are waiting on their retirement funds. Especially in France, there's this very strange system where you pay for the retirements of people who are retired at the moment. And when you go and hit your retirement funds, actually younger people are going to be paying for your retirement. So it's kind of a, it's literally a Ponzi scheme. So I think boomers are going to start to see the beginning of the shaking of that Ponzi scheme. But I know for almost a fact now, if you just do quick math, that the retirement funds, when it comes to maturity and when I'm supposed to go and retire, let's say in 40 years, I'll probably never see that money again.
No,
So
that
again, you got to think about alternative. You got to think about private capitalization.
yeah, I
And
mean, I'm not counting on any pension fund. They're all, I think they're all insolvent. I mean, look at the United States even. I mean, the uncovered funds and uncovered liabilities, and that that's why the total global debt is not, it's not 250 billion, it's actually whatever, 2.1 quadrillion, because you have to count in all the uncovered liabilities and derivatives, of
right.
course. So since you are at Knox custody, and you somehow you touched upon this, like, how does MicroStrategy now secure their these Bitcoin? Are they already insured, or how do they secure them?
Right. Yeah, it's so it's something I saw in their on their SEC filing. Because they're a publicly listed company, they do have to disclose all the risks that emanate from their activity, which is again super interesting from that standpoint. So yeah, if you look at their filing, they're disclosing that unmitigated risk of key management, right? Saying that they rely on different custodians to hold their funds, their Bitcoin holdings. But that the insurance policy may not cover them in case of a loss or a theft. So, I quote, like, while we hold the bulk of our BTC assets with established cryptocurrency custodians, a successful security breach or cyber attack could result in a partial or total loss of our BTC assets in a manner that may not be covered by insurance or indemnity provisions of our custody agreements with those custodians. So again, it's fascinating because here the goal was not to shill Knox shamelessly, I guess, in the article, but really was to ask this question, like, how do they actually custody and should a MicroStrategy or any other listed company hold their own keys in multi-sig quorums of keys, such as Unchained Capital, for instance. Or should they rely, or if they have to rely on custodial services like Knox or Fidelity Digital Assets, should these custodians be fully insured? And of course, I do believe, and we do believe at Knox, that if you're going to be using a custodial service, it should come with 100% insurance on the value that is held, ideally the physical Bitcoin, right? But these policies today do not exist. So what I mean by that is when we say value that we hold, like getting 100% on that is because our insurance today prices the holdings in US dollars. And if there's a claim event, we can reimburse, up to 100% of that value in dollars. But if the price of Bitcoin, moves during that claim and settlement period, you may not be made 100% whole on the physical Bitcoin. Though we do believe again that over time this these types of vehicles will become more sophisticated, and hopefully, we may be able to get close, if not actually physically true when it comes to settlement of these insurance policies. So yeah, it seems that MicroStrategy is using a mix of custodians, and they're not insured to cover these edge case scenarios.
Not
So
at all. They're not insured at all. I mean, not if they get like if get, because it's
if
a
you look
slow.
at if you look at the big custodians, right? I'm not gonna sort of like name names particularly in terms of their policies and like their risk level, but the BitGos, the Fidelities, the Coinbases of the world. Let's say one of these custodians claimed to have a $100 million insurance policy. When you look at an insurance policy, you got to look at two things: the breadth of coverage and then the depth of that coverage. So the breadth is really the type of risks that are transferred and essentially covered as part of the policy. Most of these custodians usually have vault risk, which is physical penetration of vaults that guard keys or backups of those keys. And if someone actually breaks into those vaults and triggers a loss, then the custodian is covered. But usually that's not enough, right? You're going to need collusion insurance, meaning operators of that custodian deciding to steal funds should also be covered. You're going to need some cyber attack, insurance coverage. Like, there's a whole bunch of other risks that you need to take into account. And once you've covered that breadth, that base, you should build the capacity to actually transfer the amount of risk that emanates from these categories. And so that can be $10 million, $100 million, $1 billion. The point is, if you have, let's say, $100 million of insurance policy, but you hold a billion, then you're actually quote unquote double spending that policy on your customers. And if there's a loss that affects all your customers and your custodian is, you know, has lost the Bitcoin holdings, that custodian may actually only be insured at 10% because they have a $100 million policy on a $1 billion holding. And so, you know, again, we believe that this is a, this can be a, an acceptable risk if it's properly disclosed and understood by consumers and other market participants. But otherwise, you know, we do believe that because it is possible and we've done it at Knox, like you should demand a 1-1 insurance policy, meaning that if you have $250 million of holdings and you're a listed company, you should demand $250 million of insurance coverage. And so these policies are hard to come by. They're usually, you know, very expensive, or they're just pretty scarce, because again, it takes a lot of work, to build a system that is, you know, secure enough and correct in its security to be able to give comfort to insurance markets that it's a risk worth covering on their books.
Fascinating. So Dib, to wrap this up, what do you think is going to change or fundamentally change the, you know, the critical adoption rate, the price of Bitcoin? Do you think that Lightning or Jack Mueller's, you know, easy user-friendly applications are going to, you know, fundamentally shift, you know, cause a shift in the ecosystem, in Bitcoin's ecosystem?
Yeah, I think, I mean, Bitcoin is still a great, it's a great savings vehicle. I'm really excited about the open source multi-sig products that are being released. So of course, you know, Unchained's Caravan is amazing. But one that I've came up that I've discovered recently, which was published pretty recently, is Lily Wallet. I haven't tried it yet, but I really want to, you know, work on it and test it, because it seems to meet a lot of pain points that I personally had when it came to multisig. So again, that's just making multisig way easier. I think it's going to be substantially bullish for Bitcoin as people withdraw from exchanges and into their own wallets. And then all the DCA services, it's a fascinating movement to see, because all these services are essentially creating a massive, you know, sustainable demand for Bitcoin. And so it just creates that hodler base, reinforces it. And because usually it's like a subscription service, right? Usually when you set it up, you just forget about it. If you put $20 a month, you're just going to be stacking. And whether or not you remember it, it's happening. So yeah, these two things I think are pretty bullish. And yeah, I'm also curious to see more full nodes being developed. More options there would be great, but more so, more than that, would be the actual education behind full nodes, like really helping noobs understand why that is that they should be running a full node. It's almost like, as an early adopter, you shouldn't be able to see your Bitcoin in your wallet unless you're running your own node, right?
Yeah.
Like wallets should actually add that in the interface or something. They should say, hey, you know, you're using a trusted node. I may be lying to you right now. You may actually not have Bitcoins. You should buy a node and set it up. So anyway, yeah, pretty excited about these things.
Very exciting. Very exciting. So, yeah, why don't you tell me, tell my listeners where they can find you, or any other, are you planning to write more articles in the near future?
Yeah, definitely. It's I may have shy of like 10 articles in draft, you know? So yeah, definitely. I want to write more. Don't want to commit to anything. I think it's just better to not talk about it and just publish when there's value publishing. So yeah, definitely. I enjoy writing. It's it's a really good moment to do a deep dive on a subject and to clarify thoughts. So we'll definitely do more of that. And if people like them, great. And then people can find me on Twitter. DMs are open. It's THIBM_. Always love to speak about Bitcoin, meat, economics, philosophy and a whole bunch of other topics. So hit me up there.
Definitely. It was really, it's really excellent article. The Bitcoin as the reserve asset, as the, what's the title again? Sorry. Is Bitcoin the world's safest reserve asset? Yeah.
Right. That's right.
On blog.noxcustody.com. Just going to put it in the show notes. So yeah, any other final thoughts, closing thoughts for the future, for the foreseeable future? Do you see anything? What's your vision?
I think it's the next time we see Bitcoin under 12K.
That's a good one.
And strap on for the next 12 months.
Alrighty. Well, hope to have you back on soon. Maybe on a panel discussion. I'd love to hear your thoughts, maybe co-moderate it also with Stephanie, because she's also the economist. I think she has a lot of questions for you, and maybe get you together. Who would be who would be a guest whom you could, whom you would say this, would be really exciting discussion? Like as a co-guest.
So many Bitcoiners on Twitter. Just take the list of people I follow, and I'd be humbled to speak with any one of them.
Fair enough.
Now,
yeah.
When it comes to institutional adoption of Bitcoin, I'd be curious to speak about that with someone from more of a traditional markets angle, right? Someone who's had the experience.
Yeah, I was thinking of Lynn
career.
Alden. I was thinking of Lynn Alden. What do you think about her? And she's really amazing.
Lynn is,
knowledge.
She's amazing.
She's
yeah.
like a super brain.
Yeah. No, it's phenomenal to see Lynn's work on Bitcoin and just the macro analysis that she does. It's brilliant. I highly encourage people to follow her if they're not already.
All right. So that's about it. Thanks so much, Tip, and talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. What you guys think? I really enjoyed this talk, as always, with Thibaut Marichal, or Tib. Make sure you follow him on Twitter. It's THIBM_, and read his article on blog.nuxcustody.com. You can follow him on Twitter, also NuxCustody on Twitter. And the article is really excellent. It's really a super thorough, concise analysis. It's Bitcoin, the world's safest reserve asset. So please pound the like button, subscribe to my YouTube channel, to my podcast platforms. Please leave me a positive review. My email at DMs are open. My email address is hello@thetotalconnector.com or kd@kevandavani.com. Make sure you follow me on LinkedIn, Telegram, Facebook if you want, but on Twitter, LinkedIn, and also my website is kevandavani.com or thetotalconnector.com. If you want to support my work monetary wise, you can still support me with fiat and or satoshis. The links are in the show notes. And yeah, make sure the institutional mass adoption is coming. The critical adoption rate is coming. With all the shit that's going on right now, unfolding, the criminal activities by central banks, governments, the lockdowns, the central bank printing of money in trillions and trillions, and inflation, hyperinflation, stagflation, unemployment, insolvencies. It's a shitstorm. I think it's the quiet before the storm. My name is Kevin Davani. I'm the Total Connector. And let me know your questions, your suggestions, your wishes, desires for the next episodes. And thanks so much for your support. Bye.